Picture this. A patient is sitting up in a hospital bed. They're joking around with their family. You look up at the monitors, and everything is just textbook.
Right, perfectly normal.
Exactly. Blood pressure is 120 over 80. Heart rate is a nice steady 75. Oxygen saturation is glowing bright green at 99%.
Yeah.
To anyone standing in that room, the situation is completely under control.
It looks entirely safe.
Yeah. But then, like 60 minutes later, alarms are just screaming. The patient's organs are rapidly failing, and the crash cart is being wheeled down the hall.
It's a terrifying
It
scenario.
really is. Or, I mean, let's zoom out. Look at a massive pine forest. Lush, green, seemingly totally vibrant and immovable.
Just a completely stable ecosystem.
Right. Yet, one single season later, a beetle infestation rolls through and turns millions of acres into dead timber.
Wow.
And in both of those cases, the data we were relying on told us everything was fine. I mean, we had the charts, we had the history, we were monitoring the situation. So why do complex living systems just shatter out of nowhere?
Well, that is really the ultimate paradox of our modern data-obsessed era, isn't it? I mean, we measure absolutely everything today.
Oh, totally. We've all got smartwatches tracking our heart rate variability right now.
Exactly. And, we use satellites to monitor soil moisture down to the square meter. We have these massive algorithms processing billions of financial trades a second.
So we have all the data in the world.
We do. We've literally never had more visibility into the individual components of our world. And yet, these sudden crashes, like the supposedly stable patient who decompensates in an hour, or the booming financial market that just evaporates overnight, these events are disappearing.
If anything, they almost seem to be getting more common.
Yeah, and sometimes our actual attempts to prevent them seem to make them worse.
Which brings us perfectly to our mission for this deep dive today. We are tackling this incredibly mind-bending text called From Coherence to Viability: A Geometry of Living
It is
Systems.
a fascinating piece of work.
It really is. It's authored by Dr. Bechara Sahili, who is an internal medicine physician and a systems thinker. And he uniquely collaborated with ChatGPT as a co-author to synthesize all the systems theory and structure the underlying mathematics.
Yeah, it's a really novel approach to writing.
And they're putting forward this radical argument. They're saying these sudden catastrophic failures are not a problem of missing data. We aren't failing because we, didn't measure the blood pressure accurately enough.
Right.
We are failing because we are entirely blind to the invisible geometry that actually holds the system together.
Exactly. We are fundamentally misreading how systems maintain what the authors call viability. I mean, we look at isolated variables and we just assume we understand the whole picture.
But viability isn't just a number on a chart.
No, not at all. It is a dynamic structural condition. And to you listening right now, grasping this concept is going to fundamentally rewire how you look at the world around you.
Oh, 100%.
Whether you're managing a team at work, or you're trying to improve your own health, or honestly just trying to make sense of global economics, this text offers a completely new lens.
It shifts us away from this exhausted, failing paradigm of trying to control our lives, right?
Yes, and introduces a framework that's based entirely on navigation instead.
But okay, to understand how to actually navigate and save a failing system, we have to start by looking in the mirror. We really have to understand why our current methods are actively breaking things.
We do, and the book kicks off by exposing this incredibly dangerous trap that almost all of us fall into. They call it the illusion of stability.
The illusion of stability, break that down for us.
Well, the illusion of stability is basically born from our absolute addiction to lagging indicators.
Lagging
Yeah,
indicators.
a lagging indicator is a measurement that reflects an output. It's a surface-level symptom or a past state.
So it's looking in the rearview mirror.
Exactly. It does not tell you the current underlying structural health of the system.
Okay, let's ground this a bit. Take me back to that ICU patient we talked about earlier, the one whose monitors looked perfect right up until they crashed.
Okay, sure. Let's say that patient has early stage sepsis. That's a severe systemic infection.
Right, very dangerous.
Very. And the clinical team is understandably intensely focused on maintaining that normal blood pressure.
So they're watching that number on the screen.
Right. And for hours, maybe even days, the numbers on the screen stay right in the green. The system appears perfectly stable.
But it's an illusion.
It is a ghost. The human body is just an absolute master of compensation. So, to keep that blood pressure up while fighting off this massive infection, the body is frantically pulling all these levers behind the scenes.
Like what kind of levers?
Well, it triggers massive vasoconstriction, literally clamping down the blood vessels.
Oh, wow.
It forces the heart to pump much harder. It actually shunts blood away from non-essential organs, like the kidneys or the gut.
Wait, so the normal blood pressure isn't actually a sign of health at all?
Yeah.
It's basically a byproduct of the body working itself to death. It's like the system is literally burning the furniture to keep the house warm.
That is a profoundly accurate way to look at it, yeah.
Mm.
The underlying physiological margins, meaning the body's emergency reserves, are being rapidly, silently depleted.
Just burning through the buffer.
Exactly. The system is operating at absolute maximal capacity just to maintain that illusion of normality on the surface. And here is the truly terrifying part.
What's that?
When those compensatory mechanisms finally run out of gas, when the last piece of furniture is burned, the deterioration is extraordinarily rapid.
Right, the cliff edge. And to the doctor who's just staring at that lagging indicator, it looks like bad luck. They say, you know, well, the blood pressure was fine 10 minutes ago.
But the failure wasn't sudden at all. The failure was this long, continuous process of structural degradation. The lagging indicator simply masked the collapse until it was mathematically irreversible.
That is wild. And we see this everywhere, right? Not just in medicine.
Oh, absolutely. We see the exact same illusion in ecology.
Yeah.
I mean, consider a large freshwater lake that's surrounded by industrial agriculture.
Okay, so lots of farms.
Right. And for decades, massive amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus runoff just flow straight into the water.
But the water looks crystal clear, right? I mean, people are swimming in it, fishing in it. It seems fine.
It remains clear because the ecosystem has buffering processes. The sediment at the bottom of the lake binds the excess nutrients, or specific biological mechanisms absorb it.
So the lagging indicator, the water clarity looks great.
It looks fantastic, but those buffers are finite. The sediment can only hold so much phosphorus.
And then what happens?
Once that capacity is exceeded by even a single gram, the lake doesn't just slowly get a little bit greener over 10 years.
No.
No, it tips almost overnight into a eutrophic state. It becomes choked with these toxic, oxygen-depleting algae blooms. All the fish die. The apparent stability was nothing more than temporary compensation.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second, because I feel like this is where human nature makes a bad situation catastrophically worse.
Oh, absolutely.
When we're tracking these lagging indicators, like the lake's clarity or the patient's blood pressure or, you know, even a company's quarterly profits, and we see them start to slip even a tiny bit, our immediate instinct is to jump in. We try to force the number back to normal. And the text calls this intervention bias, right?
Yes, intervention bias. It is really our default cultural setting.
Mm-hmm.
We see a deviation from a target, and we just apply force to correct it.
We feel like we have to do something.
Right. We assume that active, heavy-handed manipulation of system variables is the only way to achieve stability.
It's like, okay, it's like living in a house and constantly adjusting the thermostat by tiny fractions of a degree.
I can picture that, yeah.
The temperature drops by half a degree, so you manually crank the heat. Then it gets slightly too warm, so you slam on the air conditioning. You are obsessively intervening to maintain this rigid, completely artificial state of perfect temperature.
Instead of just putting on a sweater.
Exactly. Instead of opening a window to adapt to the natural variability and what happens, eventually you burn out the entire HVAC system completely.
That analogy perfectly isolates the mechanism of harm here. When you constantly override the thermostat, you are bypassing the system's own regulatory capacity.
You're doing the work for it.
Right. In medicine, when an intervention causes harm, we call it iatrogenesis. It's a term for injury caused by the healer.
Injury caused by the healer. Wow.
Yeah. And Dr. Sahili's text makes it clear that iatrogenesis is a universal property of all complex systems. When you intervene, you're never just changing one variable.
Because you can't just isolate one thing in a web.
Exactly.
Like if a doctor sees a patient's blood pressure dropping and they just pump them full of aggressive IV fluids to force the number up, they might fix the monitor.
Hmm.
But that fluid doesn't just vanish.
It leaks. The blood vessels are already compromised by the sepsis, so the massive volume of fluid leaks out into the surrounding tissues, including the lungs. Yet now the patient has pulmonary edema. They're effectively drowning in their own hospital bed. You fix the lagging indicator you were fixated on, but you severely degraded the patient's overall ability to survive. You destroyed their respiratory margin.
So you essentially played a high-stakes game of whack-a-mole. You smashed the mole labeled low blood pressure, but the mallet you used just shattered the load-bearing pillar of the patient's lungs.
That's exactly it. And if we look at ecology again, the mechanism is totally identical. You use this potent chemical pesticide to suppress a specific crop-eating insect.
Because you're optimizing entirely for the lagging indicator of pest population.
Right. But you simultaneously wipe out a native predator insect that was completely invisible to your metric.
And then what?
Suddenly, a secondary pest, which was previously kept entirely in check by that predator, experiences a massive population explosion and just decimates the crop anyway.
Wow. And the text points out that this relentless cycle of intervention leads to what they call overfitting and overcontrol. By forcing a system to exist in this tiny, rigid window of what we deem normal, we are actually training it to be incredibly fragile. We strip away its optionality.
Optionality is really the lifeblood of a complex system. It is the range of possible actions or pathways that are available when conditions change.
So having choices.
Exactly. Every time you impose a rigid external intervention, you constrain the system. You lock it into a very specific narrow corridor.
Makes sense.
If you tightly control a patient's glucose and their blood pressure and their electrolytes with continuous external machines and synthetic medications, their body's intrinsic natural regulatory capacity actually atrophies.
It just forgets how to do it.
Right. The biological system forgets how to balance itself because you've been doing all the work for it.
Mm-hmm.
So when a novel shock hits, say, a new secondary infection, the system has absolutely zero internal options left. It can't adapt. It just breaks.
Okay, so if tracking individual variables and constantly intervening to fix them is actually the very thing making our systems fragile, what are we supposed to do instead?
Well, that's the big question.
Right. The text insists we have to stop looking at the descriptive dots and start looking at the invisible lines connecting them. We have to understand the relational structure.
And to do that, the authors basically dismantle everything we think we know about systems, and they rebuild it from the ground up.
I love a good teardown.
Yeah. They introduce a minimal grammar of viability. They argue that any complex living system, whether it's a single cell, a human being, a national economy, or an entire biosphere, can be completely understood through seven primitives.
Okay, these seven primitives are the foundational ingredients, and let's not just list them, let's really see how they work together, because they form the lens we're gonna use for the rest of this deep dive.
Right, we begin with the most immediate one, state.
Right.
And that's represented mathematically by the letter X.
Oh, got it.
The state is simply the current condition or configuration of the system in this exact moment. It is exactly where you are standing right now.
Okay, X marks the spot. Our current reality. The second primitive is constraints, or C.
Yes, constraints.
These are the boundaries, the physical laws, the biological limits, the budget of a company, right?
Well, wait, I want to challenge this for a second.
Go for it.
We usually view constraints as the enemy. I mean, we talk about breaking free from constraints or having unconstrained growth. Why does the text position constraints as something fundamental to keeping a system alive?
It feels counterintuitive, I know, because we naturally associate constraints with oppression or being held back. But think about what a universe without constraints would actually look like.
Chaos.
Complete chaos. If every single state were equally accessible at all times, there would be no form at all. There would just be infinite chaotic noise.
Wow. Okay.
The text beautifully uses the example of a biological cell membrane to explain this. The membrane is a rigid physical constraint. It actively prevents molecules from moving freely in and out.
But without that wall, the cell just spills its contents into the environment and literally ceases to exist.
Precisely. By restricting movement, the membrane creates a chemical gradient, a difference in concentration between the inside and the outside.
Right. That gradient is a store of potential energy. It is the literal battery that powers all cellular metabolism.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. Without the constraint, the organization required for life just dissolves. Constraints don't just limit us, they are the structured scaffolding that actually enables coherent patterns to exist.
I really love that. It's like the boundary of the canvas is what allows the painting to have a shape. You can't paint a masterpiece on infinite air.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, moving on to the third primitive. Margins, or M. This is your buffer. It's the physiological reserve of our ICU patient, right?
Yep.
Or the cash savings in your personal bank account, or the biodiversity in a rainforest. It is the measurable capacity you have to absorb a hit before you cross a lethal threshold.
Exactly. And those hits bring us to the fourth primitive. Disturbances, or D?
D for disturbances.
Right. Disturbances are the forces acting upon the system. And they can be acute stressors, like a car crash or a sudden market flash crash, or they can be chronic pressures, like long-term inflation or a slowly progressing disease.
They're the things pushing on the walls.
Yes, disturbances actively push the system toward its constraint boundaries, testing its margins.
Okay, then we arrive at the fifth primitive, perception, or P. And we need to be clear here. This isn't just about having eyes or ears, right?
No, not at all.
For a system, perception is how it detects, interprets, and assigns meaning to signals. Like a thermostat perceives temperature, a central bank perceives inflation data.
Exactly.
If your perception is flawed or delayed, you are just flying blind.
Right. And perception is what directly informs the sixth primitive, regulation, or R.
R for regulation.
Regulation encompasses the coordinated responses. These are the feedback loops, the deliberate actions, the physiological countermeasures that the system deploys to maintain its coherence when a disturbance actually hits.
So it's the act of adjusting the sails when the wind changes.
That's it, exactly.
Which brings us to the seventh, and arguably the most vital primitive in this entire new framework. Options, or O?
Yes, options.
Options are the available pathways. The text calls this the adjacent possible. It is the set of viable next moves the system can safely make from its current state, given its constraints and its margins.
So now we have our seven pieces on the board. State, constraints, margins, disturbances, perception, regulation, and options.
X, C, M, D, P, R, and O.
You got it. But having a pile of seven car parts sitting on your garage floor doesn't give you a working engine, right?
Definitely not.
You have to connect them. And this is where the geometry actually begins in the book. How do these individual primitives interact with each other?
Well, the natural instinct is to just link them up in pairs, I think. Cause and effect, a dyad, like disturbance affects state, or perception triggers regulation. But the authors argue that pairs are completely useless for understanding complex systems. Why is that?
Because a dyad inherently lacks context. A pair can show you that an interaction is happening, but it cannot resolve the actual meaning of that interaction.
Give me an example of that.
Okay, let's look at a disturbance in a state. Let's say the disturbance is intense physical exercise, and the state is your body. Is that interaction destructive, or is it beneficial?
Well, I mean, if I'm healthy, it builds muscle. But if I'm recovering from a massive heart attack, it might actually kill me.
Exactly. You cannot know the outcome just by looking at those two elements. You need a third element to resolve the ambiguity.
Ah, I see.
You need margin. Do you have the physiological reserve to handle the exercise? If yes, it's adaptive. If no, it's destructive.
So the third element anchors the meaning.
Yes. This is why the authors organize the primitives into triads. A triad is the minimal unit of relational coherence in a complex system. It provides direction, action, and context all at once.
Okay, so they took these seven primitives and they mapped them into seven functional triads. And that creates a complete geometric structure. And to do this, they used a concept from projective geometry called the Fano plane.
The Fano plane, yes. It is an incredibly elegant mathematical structure. Picture a triangle with a circle perfectly inscribed inside it.
Okay, triangle with a circle inside.
Right, and then lines bisecting each angle of the triangle.
Yeah.
All intersecting at a single point right in the dead center. It contains exactly seven points and exactly seven lines.
And here is the absolute magic rule of the Fano plane. It's like a perfectly balanced Sudoku puzzle. Every single pair of points appears on exactly one line together. No more, no less.
Everything is perfectly distributed.
There is no overlap and there are no gaps. It's mathematically beautiful.
It really is. And the initial model proposed in the text assigned the seven primitives to the seven points of this plane, creating seven functional channels or triads.
Right.
For example, they had a geometry of viability triad, which was constraints, margins, and state. CMX.
Okay.
They had a response channel triad, state, disturbance, and regulation, XDR. And they had a control loop triad, state, perception, and regulation, XPR.
But as Dr. Sahili and his AI co-author were actually running the mathematics on this structure, they hit a massive wall. They discovered a fundamental flaw in their own original model. Sudoku puzzle was broken.
Yes, they realized they had a structural inconsistency. The pair, consisting of state, which is X, and regulation, which is R, was duplicated.
It showed up twice.
Exactly. It appeared in the response channel, X, D, R, and it appeared again in the control loop, X, P, R.
Now, if I'm just looking at a mathematical model, why does it really matter if a couple of letters show up twice?
Because in a minimal projective geometry like this, a duplication destroys what we call minimal closure. It overdetermines the system.
Correct, overdetermines it.
Yeah, if the pair XR appears twice, it means the system is assigning multiple competing contextual meanings to the exact same relationship.
Oh, that sounds bad.
It creates mathematical tension. But much more profoundly, it creates a massive philosophical bias.
And here's where it gets really interesting, to me at least. By having regulation, which is essentially intervention control, the act of forcing a fix, by having that show up too often in relation to the state, the math was heavily weighted.
Heavily weighted.
The model was inadvertently assuming that a system survives primarily by constantly regulating itself back to a desired state.
Yes. The math itself was literally suffering from intervention bias.
Oh.
It favored a control-oriented view of the world. It suggested that viability comes from perceiving a problem and immediately regulating the state. Detect deviation, apply force.
Wait, are you saying that because this math model was slightly imbalanced, it accidentally proved why human beings are so toxically obsessed with micromanaging everything?
Yeah, physically did, yeah.
Like, our own psychological bias toward control bled right into the geometry. We want to perceive a bad number, P, and immediately regulate it, R, to fix the state, X. I see the blood pressure drop, I push the IV fluid.
That is precisely what happened. And the authors realized that if they left the model this way, they would just be mathematically formalizing the exact same intervention-heavy paradigm that destroys optionality and causes iatrogenic collapse in the first place.
They had to fix the geometry.
They had to balance the Fano plane.
Which leads to what they call the minimal correction. I love this part. They didn't just scrap the whole theory. They made one tiny surgical substitution that caused an absolute philosophical earthquake.
They did. They looked at that duplicated control loop triad. State, perception, regulation, X, P, R. And they replaced regulation R with options O.
So the triad became X, P, O, state, perception, and options.
Yes. They transformed the control loop into a perception possibility mapping.
They deleted control and replaced it with possibility. That is deep. What does that actually look like in practice, though?
Well, in the old flawed model, perception directly triggers regulation. You see a problem, you act to fix it.
Knee-jerk reaction.
Exactly. But in the corrected model, perception does not trigger an immediate action. Instead, perception maps the options. It evaluates the landscape of what is viable from your current state. Regulation is moved further downstream. It only operates within the space of the options you have mapped.
Let me try an analogy here, because I think this is crucial. It's the difference between driving a car on a sheet of black ice and suddenly perceiving that you are sliding.
Oh, good one.
The interventionist control loop instinct, the old model, is to slam your foot on the brakes. You perceive the slide and you forcefully attempt to regulate the state of the car back to zero velocity.
Right.
But on ice, slamming the brakes locks the wheels, destroys whatever traction you had left, and essentially guarantees you crash.
And under the new model?
Under the new model, you perceive the slide, but instead of forcing an outcome, you map your options based on the momentum. You steer into the skid.
Yes.
You aren't trying to force the car to stop. You are aligning with the physical dynamics to navigate the momentum safely until your tires find grip again. You are managing the adjacent possible.
That is a phenomenal analogy.
Yeah.
Slamming the brakes is what ancient Chinese philosophy actually refers to as Yu Wei. Yeah, action through deliberate, forceful, unnatural effort. Steering into the skid, however, is Wu Wei. Action through alignment, effortless navigation, and flowing around constraints rather than fighting them.
So by mathematically substituting options for regulation, the authors shifted the entire operating system from a paradigm of rigid control to a paradigm of fluid navigation.
They did. And mathematically, swapping that one letter fixed the Fano plane completely. Every pair of primitives now appears exactly once. Every primitive participates in exactly three triads. The Sudoku board is perfectly balanced.
It achieved minimal closure. And by doing so, it forces us to change our fundamental operational question. We have to stop asking, you know, how do we force the system to return to our predetermined target state?
Right.
And start asking, given our current margins and constraints, what viable transitions are available to us from here?
Because you can't predict a complex system anyway.
Exactly. And to really drill down into why focusing on options and margins is so much more powerful than focusing on regulation, the authors pull in four heavy-hitting external theories from biology, physics, and economics.
They weave these seamlessly into the geometry.
Yeah, they call them the four pillars of viability. Let's explore these, starting with Terence Deacon.
Terence Deacon is a biological anthropologist whose work centers heavily on emergence. He formalizes the concept we discussed earlier regarding constraints. he introduces the idea of constraints as causal absence.
Causal absence. That sounds like a paradox.
It does.
Yeah.
We are conditioned to think of causality as a presence, like a cue ball hitting an eight ball, a physical force causing an effect. But Deakin argues that what is prevented from happening is equally causal.
The book uses protein folding to explain this, right?
Yes, exactly. A protein is this long chain of amino acids that must fold into a highly specific three-dimensional shape to function properly.
Right.
It doesn't fold into that exact shape merely because of the chemical bonds that actively pull it together. It achieves that shape because physical constraints and thermodynamic laws rigidly exclude millions of incorrect configurations.
Wow.
The constraint acts as a structured absence. It channels the system into viability by defining exactly what it cannot do. In our geometry, the constraint primitive, C, is the filter. It defines the walls of the maze.
Okay, that makes sense. Pillar 2 brings in theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman and his concept of the adjacent possible. This maps directly to our options primitive, though.
Kaufman's insight here is just breathtaking. The adjacent possible is the set of all states that are strictly one step away from where you are right now.
Just one step.
Right. And the crucial realization Kaufman brings is that the future of any evolving complex system is what he calls non-prestatable.
Non-prestatable, meaning we can't state it beforehand.
Exactly. You cannot predict the future, not because you lack data, but because the future literally does not exist yet. As a system moves into a new state, it fundamentally alters the landscape, unlocking entirely new, previously inconceivable possibilities.
Like, okay, if humanity invents the wheel, we suddenly unlock the adjacent possibility of building a cart.
Yes.
But before the wheel was invented, you couldn't predict a traffic jam.
No, you couldn't.
The possibility space physically expanded the moment the state changed. This is why attempting to tightly control a system based on, like, a five-year prediction always fails. You are aiming at a future that will be redefined by the very steps you take to get there.
Right.
You have to preserve your optionality so you can pivot when the landscape inevitably changes.
Which flows perfectly into the third pillar. Nassim Nicholas Taleb's work on fragility and anti-fragility. Taleb examines how systems respond to volatility, randomness, and stress.
Fragility is when you shatter because of a surprise. Anti-fragility is when the surprise actually benefits you. Like a hydra, you cut off one head to grow back. Or like human muscle tearing during a workout and repairing stronger.
Exactly. Now, how does that map to our geometry? Mathematically, a system becomes fragile when its options O and its margins M collapse towards zero.
So no buffer, no choices.
Right. If you have no buffer to absorb the shock of a disturbance and no alternative pathways to maneuver into, you will absolutely break. Anti-fragility requires convexity. A dynamic where you have limited downside but open-ended upside.
And how do you get that convexity?
You achieve systemic convexity by maintaining a rich, diverse set of options and deep, resilient margins.
If you are listening to this on your commute right now, think about your department at work or even your own career. Are you optimizing yourself into fragility?
It's a very common trap.
It is. If you max out your calendar so you have absolutely zero free time, that is zero margin, and if you hyper-specialize in one single proprietary software program so you can't pivot to any other role, that is zero options.
And then a disturbance hits.
Right. Say an AI tool automates that specific software. You are going to experience a catastrophic collapse. You have structurally engineered yourself for failure because you optimized for maximum efficiency in one specific state instead of preserving your viability geometry.
That is a perfect, deeply relevant application. Efficiency is very often the enemy of viability. And that brings us to the final pillar, which brings all of these concepts into continuous dynamic motion. Pillar 4 is Adrian Bajan's constructal law.
Bajan is a physicist, right? This is about the physics of flow.
Yes, it is. The constructal law dictates that for a finite-sized system to persist in time, to live, it must evolve in such a way that it provides easier access to the imposed currents that flow through it.
Okay, visualize that for me.
Think of the branching architecture of a river basin, or the jagged forks of a lightning bolt, or even the incredibly intricate vascular network in your own lungs.
They all look like trees.
Exactly. They all spontaneously form tree-like structures to optimize flow across a space.
But how did the authors map a physics law about river basins into the seven primitives?
They defined flow mathematically as options multiplied by margins, filtered by constraints. O times M under C.
O times M under C.
The potential of any system to generate flow pathways is directly proportional to its available inassins. Options multiplied by its functional margins. but those pathways must navigate through the physical or systemic constraints.
So if either your options or your margins collapse to zero,
the equation zeroes out. Your flow bottlenecks, coherence is lost, and the system dies. Viability is not a dot on a graph. It is the continuous, unimpeded flow of energy, resources, and information through the adjacent possible.
Okay, so we have the pieces. We understand the Fano plane geometry. We have the heavy-hitting philosophical backing of Deakin, Kaufman, Taleb, and Bijan. But how do we actually use this?
That is the practical question.
Yeah, if I'm looking at a failing startup or a sick patient, how do I apply this math to see if they're going to survive? That brings us to the core engine of the book, the mathematics of navigation, or the hierarchy of invariance.
The authors provide a three-level viability algorithm. It essentially evaluates the structural integrity of the system from the bottom up. They use the term invariance because these are conditions that must remain mathematically constant regardless of what the system is doing for the system to survive.
Let's walk through a single continuous scenario to explain these three levels. Let's use a tech startup company that is launching a new app. Level one is local. The math term they use is omega.
Omega evaluates pairwise compatibility. At the most granular level, it asks a very simple question. Are these two specific primitives allowed to interact within the structure of the system? It's a localized filter.
Okay, so for a startup, let's say the CEO, who represents perception, wants to suddenly pivot the entire marketing strategy, which represents regulation. Omega asks, is that interaction structurally sound?
Right.
Does the CEO actually have accurate market research to inform that regulation? If the CEO is just guessing based on a whim, there is no valid link. The interaction is forbidden by the system structure. If they force it anyway, it will cause harm.
Precisely. You check the local connection first. If Omega is satisfied and the pair is compatible, we move up to level two, meso. They call this N3, or the cubic norm.
So if level one asks, are these two things compatible? Level two asks, do they form a complete closed loop, triadic coherence?
Yes. Even if two elements are compatible, if they don't form a complete functional triad with a third element, the action is degenerate. It fragments the system.
Okay, going back to our startup.
Right, so let's say the CEO has the market research, perception, and makes the marketing pivot, regulation. Omega is fine, but N3 asks about the rest of the triad. What about the state of the product?
Ah, does the actual software kind of support the new marketing promises?
Exactly. If the marketing team is selling a feature that the engineering team hasn't even built yet, the triad is broken, the loop doesn't close, the regulation is completely disconnected from the actual state. The system loses meso-level coherence.
The gears are spinning, but they aren't actually touching each other. Okay. Let's say they pass in three. The marketing matches the product. Then we arrive at the final boss. Level three, global. The I4 quartic invariant.
This is whole system viability. Does the entire network of all seven interlocking triads hold together as a single functioning geometry? Do the local loops integrate in a way that respects the absolute boundary constraints, C, and preserves the company's overall margins, M?
So for the startup, the marketing loop works locally. But what if the marketing campaign costs $10 million and the company only has $2 million in the bank?
Then they fail.
The local triad was coherent, but it completely violated the global invariant. It depleted the margin to zero. The company goes bankrupt. The whole system fragments and dies.
Exactly. If I4 drops to zero, the system collapses, regardless of how efficient the individual departments thought they were being. But I really want to highlight something crucial here about this algorithm. The text explicitly states that this mathematics is navigational, not predictive.
I need to push back on that a little bit. If I can calculate omega, N3, and I4 to evaluate a transition, but it won't actually tell me what the ultimate outcome will be, isn't that just flying blind with extra steps? If we aren't predicting outcomes, how is this safe?
It is safe precisely because you are using these local constraints to bound your exploration rather than hallucinating a future that doesn't actually exist. Remember, Kaufman's adjacent possible.
Right, non-prestatable.
Yes. If you try to predict a complex system 50 steps ahead, you will invariably be wrong. The landscape will change. That false confidence is exactly what leads to catastrophic, heavy-handed intervention.
So I'm not using a map drawn 10 years ago. I'm using a compass and a walking stick to test the immediate terrain right in front of me.
Beautifully stated. Navigation means continuously evaluating your immediate local transitions. You just ask, does this single next step satisfy omega? Does it maintain N3 coherence? Does it preserve the I4 global invariant?
Checking the footing.
Right. You maintain structural integrity step by step. You stay within the boundaries of what is viable, exploring the possibility space safely rather than aiming blindly at a far-off target and ignoring the cliffs right in front of you.
Let's take this compass and walking stick out of the realm of abstract math and tech startups and put it to work in the real world. The text applies this geometry across three massive domains: medicine, ecology, and economics. Let's start in the hospital. How does a doctor actually use the Fano plane to treat a patient?
It provides a rigorous mathematical justification for watchful waiting. It completely reframes how we view physiological symptoms. As we discussed earlier, every aggressive medical intervention consumes margin. It burns the patient's physiological reserve.
Okay, so say a patient comes in with a high fever. The immediate interventionist instinct is to crush the fever, right? Give them antipyretics, drop the temperature, regulate the state back to normal.
Right. But the viability algorithm forces the physician to ask, is this fever a failure of this system, or is it an adaptive, coherent response?
A feature, not a bug.
Exactly. A fever is very often a compensatory mechanism. The body is deliberately using up its own margin to navigate a disturbance, in this case, an infection. The geometry asks, does dropping the fever artificially preserve global coherence?
Probably not. I mean, if you suppress the fever, you might suppress the natural immune response. Now, the bacteria multiply faster. So you have to hit the patient with massive, broad-spectrum antibiotics.
And those antibiotics annihilate the gut microbiome.
Right. The loss of the microbiome drops the patient's blood pressure. Now you have to give them vasopressors. You've triggered an iatrogenic cascade that literally kills the patient, all because you wanted a normal number on a thermometer.
Exactly. The geometry of viability supports allowing the system to declare its own trajectory. You monitor the margins. As long as the invariants hold, as long as the patient's core physiological loops aren't fragmenting, you allow the body to navigate the adjacent possible.
You stay out of its way.
You preserve your treatment options rather than overtreating numbers on a chart and causing a structural collapse.
What about ecology? We talked about the lake earlier, but how does this change large-scale environmental management?
In ecology, the geometry serves as a severe warning against optimizing for single descriptive variables. Industrial agriculture, for instance, attempts to maximize crop yield, which is a single state variable, X.
And to enforce that single outcome, they dump synthetic fertilizers, spray blanket pesticides, and eradicate all competing vegetation to create a perfect monoculture.
But according to the constructal law, that destroys the flow networks.
It completely dismantles them, doesn't it?
It does. It destroys the biodiversity. And in ecological terms, biodiversity is the margin and the options. A highly optimized, simplified monoculture farm might produce staggering yields for 5 years, but it is infinitely fragile.
Because it has no backup plan.
Right. A single novel pathogen or an unexpected drought will wipe out the entire crop in weeks because the system has absolutely zero alternative pathways to adapt. Effective ecological management must preserve relational connectivity and flow. It has to nurture diversity to maintain optionality rather than enforcing rigid control.
And finally, we arrive at economics and governance. And I want to be very, very clear here for the listener. We are absolutely not taking sides on any political ideology. The authors aren't making a political statement here. They're looking strictly at the math.
Right, just applying impartial mathematical primitives to human societal structures.
Exactly. And what it reveals is deeply unsettling.
The structural mechanisms of viability are completely domain agnostic. The text argues that in economics, heavy-handed overregulation creates extreme systemic fragility. When a central authority attempts to tightly control economic outcomes by imposing rigid top-down rules, it structurally compresses the options available to individuals and small businesses.
It forces the entire market into narrow, predefined pathways.
Yeah.
So when a disturbance hits, say, a global supply chain shock or a sudden technological shift, the agents inside the system aren't legally or structurally allowed to adapt. The adjacent possible has been legislated out of existence.
Correct. The system loses its anti-fragility. But the text goes even deeper, introducing a profoundly important concept called structural violence. In this context, violence isn't a physical act. It is a structural condition of the geometry.
How does that work?
Structural violence occurs when an economic or social system is organized in such a way that specific groups of people have their constraints artificially tightened, while their margins and options are systematically erased.
Let's really explore this empathetically, because this isn't just abstract theory. Think about a single mother working 3 minimum wage jobs just to afford rent. Her constraints, time, money, physical exhaustion are absolute iron walls. Her margin savings, physiological rest, a safety net are at absolute zero. And because she is locked into the survival loop, her options like going back to school, finding a better job, moving to a cheaper city, are non-existent. The possibility space has completely collapsed around her.
That is a stark, accurate representation of the math. According to the constructal law, where flow equals options times margins under constraints, her capacity for flow is practically zero.
Wow.
The system is violent because it structurally enforces this geometry upon her, making her infinitely fragile. If she gets a single flat tire or her child gets sick for one day, she faces catastrophic collapse, eviction, starvation.
And yet the broader system might look fine.
Oh, the national economy might look totally stable, GDP might be soaring, the lagging indicators look great. But internally, for millions of people trapped in that compressed geometry, relational coherence is fundamentally broken.
It doesn't matter if you are a critical care doctor treating a fading patient, a park ranger managing a fragile forest, or a policymaker writing laws that dictate human lives. The fatal mistake is exactly the same. Attempting to force a complex, breathing web of relationships into a straight, predictable line.
You cannot do it.
You just can't. The mathematics of reality simply will not allow it. If you try, the Fano plane breaks, the invariants fail, the options collapse, and the system shatters.
That is really the ultimate synthesis of Dr. Sakili and his AI co-author's work. It demands a total paradigm shift. We must abandon the illusion that we can control complex systems. Control assumes the future can be perfectly specified and forcefully engineered into existence.
Which Kaufman proved is impossible.
Exactly. Navigation, however, accepts the profound reality that the future is non-prestatable. It must be discovered step by step through coherent exploration within safe boundaries.
We've journeyed from lagging indicators in iatrogenesis to the Fano plane and the constructal law. We've seen how a single duplicated letter in a math equation can reflect our deepest psychological flaws. But all of this staggering complexity really boils down to one final ultimate thesis from the book.
Yes. The final principle is elegant and unyielding. Systems remain viable not by controlling outcomes, but by navigating the space of possibilities within constraints.
So powerful.
Stability is not the absence of change. Stability is the preservation of relational coherence across continuous change.
We spend so much of our fleeting lives trying to exert total control. I mean, we try to control our bodies, micromanage our teams, dictate our children's futures, and tightly engineer our finances. We grip the steering wheel so tightly, knuckles totally white, desperately trying to force the car to stay perfectly straight on a sheet of black ice. But what if that white-knuckled grip is the very thing making you fragile? As you go about your week, look at the complex systems that make up your life, your relationships, your work, your own health, and ask yourself a simple question. Am I trying to forcefully dictate an outcome here, or am I just trying to maintain my margins and keep my options open? Think back to that hospital monitor analogy from the very beginning. You cannot fix a complex living system just by pointing at a broken line on a chart and applying brute force. Because according to the geometry of living systems, the path to survival isn't found by locking yourself into a perfect plan. It's found by always, always leaving yourself a way out.